From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. I want you to meet Sam Milton today. He is a singer, songwriter, musician. He's from Portland, and he's got a brand new album out. It's called Nausea. And before we meet him, let's listen to a track. Here's the title track, Nausea.
You're turning sail, one final push, some pretty story that you wish you never had. Now flush and pale, stumbling your words, trembling and shaking just to mirror some kind of nerve. The nausea swells until the shame flush down and around yourself, 'cause it sinks its claws in you for the magnitude of everything that's gone to hell. And it tells you solitude is the proper tool to handle any overwhelm. And it seems to sell. Grate your teeth, wine stained and warm, an interwoven crack between your cast and mold. Cut these yourself, stitch from the wall, a passing look from a love you couldn't hold. The nausea swells until you lose the lives of one way wells, 'cause it sinks its claws in you for the magnitude of everything that's gone to hell. And it tells you solitude is a proper tool to handle any overwhelm. And it seems to sell.
Nausea from Sam Milton. He's a singer, songwriter, and he's my guest on this week's show. Sam, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I like your album very much. Where did you record it?
It's all been here in my apartment. I've got this studio apartment that used to be a garage at some point, and they've renovated it and sold it off as a little apartment. And so about half of it is crammed with music equipment, and I got a digital piano and some violins and drum set in here. So it was all done in here over the course of about 2 years or so, partially while I was finishing up school and working.
Where were you going to school?
I graduated from Portland State University.
Uh-huh. You play all the instruments on the record?
Yeah.
And you do all the vocals. There's kind of layered vocals on there.
Yeah, everything. All me mixed and produced and sung. It's all, it's no digital instruments. So everything is recorded and me playing it.
And how many instruments do you play?
I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of instruments that I could say I quote unquote play, but like, don't put me on the spot with them. It's sort of like, you could do it in about 80 takes or so and get it to sound right. But I'd say I play firmly play at least guitar, violin, viola, drums, and maybe a little bit of piano.
And you sing. But, and, you're,
and
you're
I sing, yeah.
Good singer. And, well, I want to know a lot more, but let's play another track. A track I like a lot is called Someone New. Can you tell me something about this track before I play it?
Yeah, it's, I almost did not include this track on the album. It's very funny. It's my mom's favorite. And I recorded it years ago on like a four track, like one of those cassette tape Tascam four tracks.
Yeah.
And I liked it then, but then I sort of just forgot about it. And like a year or so later, my mom kept bringing it up and saying, you have to re-record this. You have to put it on the album. It has to be there. So I did. And then even then after that, I still wasn't going to put it on the album. But I eventually came around and ended up, yeah, really enjoying it.
Well, good.
So you can thank my mom for it.
Thanks, Nancy. Someone New by Sam Milton, who's my guest here this week on From the Bookshelf. So, Sam, did you study music when you were at school?
No, I studied psychology and I had a minor in English as well.
And so are you self-taught on all of your instruments? Are you took lessons or what?
Well, I took lessons for probably about a decade with violin, starting at like 3 or 4 years old. But as far as, I guess I took some piano and guitar lessons at different points in my life. But as far as like consistently playing and like really getting into the instruments, that's been mostly self-taught. I think I had like 2 lessons with guitar ever. Yeah, for the most part, it's all me.
Yeah. And so who are your musical influences? You must have listened to a lot of records because there's a way that you're playing that seems like you couldn't have just made that up yourself.
Yeah, well, I take quite a lot from Elliott Smith. I'm kind of like a mega super fan of him. Mm-hmm. Another, you know, brilliant Portland artist, and I really believe he's like one of the best to ever do it. I've been really into Nick Drake. Another big inspiration is Jessica Pratt. Her album On Your Own Love Again was really just one of my favorites. A little bit of Adrian Linker, and Beatles too, obviously.
The Beatles. Oh yeah, I've heard of them. well, that's interesting. So you just named, I don't know, five or six people, and two of them are current making records. And
yes.
The rest of them are, well, I mean, Paul McCartney still makes records and Ringo still makes records, but the Beatles haven't made a record since 1970 and Nick Drake, 73 or four or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think it was maybe 92 or something that Elliot Smith passed away. How'd you get exposed to this older stuff? Cause you're, how old are you? 45?
Yeah, 45. I'm 24.
Uh-huh. Oh, the numbers are reversed.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think overall there's most of the people my age I know almost primarily listen to old music. I used to kind of hold that as like a badge of honor where I was like, didn't listen to anything current at all and had no idea what people were talking about when they referenced like more contemporary artists. But I've since really branched out and found a lot of really amazing stuff currently. I guess I got really into Elliot Smith from actually my sister at first. I must have been like 16 or 17. And I remember she had him on a bunch of her Spotify playlists. So to impress her, I started adding those songs to my Spotify playlist as well. And then I really ended up falling in love with the music.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess I think in the streaming age, it's really easy for everything to sort of blend together as far as years and when an artist was active or not. You know, you don't have to necessarily go find someone at a local show to be aware of them and know a lot about them as well. So
speaking of streaming, so your album is a digital album. I found it on Bandcamp and also on your own website, which is Sam-Milton, or how do you say it? What's the
name? Yeah, Sam-Milton.com.
Sam-Milton.com. And there's no CD, there's no LP.
I made some CDs. I have about 50 of them sitting here in a box in the corner.
Oh, good. Send me one.
Sort of like a selling out of the back of the van kind of deal.
Oh, good. So when you play your gigs, you have them there on a table.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And speaking of that, do you play often?
Honestly, not super often, but I'm aiming to have as much as I can do over the winter and through into the next year. Sort of an exciting thing. I don't want to like make too big of an announcement in case it doesn't work out, but I am putting together a live band to play the shows with the backing band, and that will be really exciting. So I have some sort of loosely booked events over the next few months, but nothing like firmly down. I did a big show at the end of August here in the Washington Park Amphitheater, just like right in the grassy area of the Rose Garden. And that was really cool. That was definitely the biggest audience I've played so far. And I was up there for an hour. I was in another band playing violin and doing backing vocals. And that was Christopher Jack, who's a producer for the Andy Warhols. So that was really fun. And everyone dressed up in little themes. And there was a tea party on stage where people could order tea and sit there in fancy little chairs. It was very, very, very sweet.
Sounds nice.
Yeah.
Well, I want you to pick the next one of your songs that we're going to hear. So which one from your album is your favorite?
Oh, that's tough. My first thing that came to my mind was Tired Now Waiting for You.
All right, let's hear it.
Wish you came along to sight to be seen. Wish I came along beside you and me. If everything was wrong, then why can't I leave? If things have fell apart, bright broken dream. Cause I'm tired now waiting for you. Been lying on the coast of us too. Been bored now without your clues. Now I'm bored just waiting for you. inside on yourself. A simple lullaby to no one else. Don't think that it's wrong if that's what you'd like. Just wish I belonged, that you try. Cause I'm tired.
Now Waiting for You from Sam Milton. He's a singer songwriter from Portland, and he's my guest today. I was going to ask you this, but you were just saying that you're putting a band together. But when your record is so layered, there's so many vocals and guitar parts, is it frustrating when you're just up there, you and a guitar playing, to get the sound you want for the song?
I don't know if it's frustrating. I think it's different. I like it in its own way, because, you know, every song had to start that way. And I think, like, for a song to be interesting with all those layers on top, it should be pretty interesting to play just with acoustic and vocal alone. There are certain moments, like the song Babies on the record, is sort of, I really like the way at the end it kind of has this explosion of sounds, and that you really can't do. Yeah. With just an acoustic guitar. But I don't know. I think for me, it's less about it being frustrating and more that just playing live in like a kind of rock and roll sense is just so fun.
Yeah.
I mean, you really have to be like so self-serious a little bit when you're on stage with just an acoustic guitar, and you're sitting there and everyone's kind of like leaning in and listening. And then when it's a loud rock band, you got distortion pedals and you're standing up and it's a microphone. It feels, I don't know, really, really, really cool. And having a drummer play and, you know, controlling the dynamics and, you know, yelling. I think it's just, it's different and it's a lot of fun. It's all fun to me.
Do you see yourself doing this? You're going to be a musician, or you're going to open a psychology shop now that you have your degree?
That's a good question. I mean, I think, quote unquote, making it in music as a career is like hitting the lottery a little bit. And that would be my absolute preference, you know, to just keep releasing records and promoting and making enough income to support myself that way. I think that'd be really interesting. And really, really cool. I would prefer it that way.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, I don't want to hold on to something if it's not working out for way too long. And I do love psychology, so it's always an option for me.
Though I have some fallback.
I wouldn't prefer it that way.
Tell me a little bit about your songwriting. Do the songs just come easily to you? They just flow? You have 10 of them on the album. Are there 50 that 40 I haven't heard, or are these your songs?
No, I think I had probably 30 songs I recorded just for the album, and there was probably hundreds that I wrote and didn't use. I write a lot. I probably write a song a day at this point. Most of them are really bad. So it's just kind of the ones that I can remember. Uh-huh. But it's not always like easy and flowing. I definitely have experienced like writer's block and a lot of frustration, especially when you're just like trying to force, you know, your hand to make creativity happen. And you're like, come on, just write the song. I want to do it. I want to write something. It's usually not how it works. But I feel like if I'm not thinking about it enough and I'm just maybe improvising or trying to make something up on the spot without any pressure of turning it into some arranged form, that's kind of when songs start to pop up.
That's neat. When you say, okay, I remember this song, I like it, I'm going to keep it, do you hear the arrangement? Or is the arrangement a more improvisational activity?
I think it depends on the song. I think the newer songs I've been writing now have a little bit more of an arrangement in mind, where, you know, I think earlier when I'd write, it would sort of just be a repeating like chord pattern or riff throughout the whole song with, you know, a change in a chorus or a bridge or whatever. And now there's sort of more designated parts for everything. Like, you know, okay, this instrumental part is going to play something different on the guitar than the vocal verse. And so at certain points I can definitely hear like, okay, it'd be cool to have some drums at this part or some strings playing it. And oftentimes I'll record a demo of a song. This is kind of how I know I like it, is I record a demo of a song and then I'll find myself listening over and over to that demo. And as I do that, I can kind of hear exactly what I might want out of it at some point, or like where I would like vocal harmonies and where I would like just additional movement within the instrumentation.
Let's hear another song. Do you want to pick one?
I guess since I brought up Babies, we could play that one.
Watching all the light love babies coming two at a time, kissing all the life of maybes, it's a luxury out of line. Cause they got their light out safely if it's dark or it's bright, so kissing all them till it makes me miss what's been and then it's no longer mine. I'm fine, I'll say it's right. I'm fine, I'm saving cause it wouldn't be the same on my own. But I get nauseous knocking on the door of anyone that I never have known. Cause just to have a night out lately, it's harder than I could show. So kissing all of them till it makes me feel like I'm ready to blow. I'm fine, I'll say it's right. I'm fine, I'll make it by. The night she told me to wait here and never came like I hoped. And since the signs and lines are shaky, I think I'll find my way home. I'm fine, I'll say it's right. I'm fine, I'll make it by. Alright.
watching all the light love babies coming two at a time. Kissing all the life of maybes, it's a luxury out of line. And since the signs of minds are shaped, I think I'll find my way home. So kissing all the time until it makes me feel like I'm ready to blow. I'm fine, I say it's right. I'm fine, I make it fine.
Thank you for being with me. The singer-songwriter is Sam Milton, and his new album is called Nausea. You can find it at sam-milton.com, or you can find it on Bandcamp, or stream it on your streaming service. And Sam Milton, I wish you good luck, and thank you for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Claire Rosen returns to the show this week. Claire Rosen is an award-winning visual artist. She's known for her photographs of animals and nature in sort of dreamlike settings. And she has a new book. It's called Birds of a Feather, and it's a beautiful book. And I'm so happy to say, Claire Rosen, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm just delighted to be here.
I'm so glad. It's been a while since we spoke. I can't remember. Several years, at least.
Yes. 2017, 16, maybe.
Yeah. So you have a new book, and it's stunning, and it's pictures of birds. And so obviously, you know, you had to kill the birds and stuff them in order to take
no.
the picture. No? That's how they
I'm
always
not Audubon.
That's how you did it, right. Okay. Audubon killed more birds straight. Than anybody. So
certainly did. So the project is about 13 years of work, but it's all photographed with live animals, and none of them were harmed for the making of the project. But I basically create portrait situations for them to be in, complete with sort of lighting setups, and I bring backgrounds to the birds, and they're photographed against these sort of ornate wallpaper or fabric backgrounds that reference the sort of Victorian era in their motifs. And I try to match the birds aesthetically to the backgrounds and sort of create a engaging, hopefully, portrait of them.
Well, I can see you. My listeners can't, but you look like a Victorian gal, right? You're dressed in a Victorian way. You wear your hair. Are you obsessed with Victorian time?
I've been time traveling. I do feel very influenced by the Victorian era. Certainly, my mom had quite a bit to do with that. So it's definitely a visual aesthetic that I return to repeatedly in my work. And I thought that sort of interestingly enough for the conceptual tie-ins of this body of work, it was relevant also because that time period really had quite a lot of exploration of the natural world, but also sort of exploitation and this desire to be surrounded by nature. I think of the Victorian curio cabinets and aviary collections. It was really a time of collecting nature and being inspired by it, but I think maybe at the time a little less aware of the consequences of that fascination. So I'm picking up and discussing both the aesthetics of that time period, but also some of the things that were going on in terms of our relationship to the natural world.
And so you have, like, I can see a picture of an owl, and he's, or he or she, I don't know. How do you, I guess it's only important if you're an owl, on a branch, and then this piece of beautiful wallpaper or whatever it is behind. How did you manage to get this owl to pose for this picture? What are your techniques?
Each photo shoot's a little bit different. Obviously, I think one of the biggest takeaways from this project and working with so many birds is just how unique their personalities are. It's about as diverse as human interaction. So just as you might prepare for a portrait of a person, each time I walk in, I'm prepared to sort of make a connection with the bird and understand what would make that particular bird the most comfortable to have a good photo shoot. So the project began with parrots and more domestic, easily accessible birds. I used to have parakeets myself. So the first sort of test shots of the proof of concept were done with my own parakeets. And then I had approached a pet store to, I basically set up a portrait studio in their lobby, and brought many, many background options with me so that I could, you know, see what would work the best. And we just spent the day photographing, and it was really such a thrilling and engaging process for me. I really fell in love with these creatures. And the project sort of grew in that way. And I had, I was lucky enough to have an exhibit in Dubai, in the UAE, and I was introduced to some working falcons in that part of the world. And that sort of opened my eyes to the whole world of raptors and owls and birds of prey. So that sort of set the project on another volume, if you will. And I worked with a number of sanctuaries and rescues and with ambassador birds that can no longer be returned to the wild, some working birds with professional falconers, and then some in the National Aviary. Elmwood Zoo, which is quite near me, has a collection of lovely ambassador birds that I was lucky enough to work with. So I traveled quite a bit to be able to get them. And then during COVID, when we couldn't really travel very much, I did all my neighbors' chickens and ducks in these sort of outside the portrait studios. And that was a whole nother ball game, as they have quite quirky personalities, and they're really just so funny. So it's a span of about 13 years of work since the first one, but not sort of consistently working on it the whole time.
Yeah. They're very beautiful, and you have some pretty unusual birds. And I'm just wondering, you know, did you ever have any incidents where the birds wouldn't behave or they're tried to peck you?
Well, certainly if the birds don't want to participate, they don't. You can't really direct them as you might direct a person. So it really, I'm at the mercy of their interest and willingness to participate, which feels like a real gift and a real collaboration, I would say. I have had a couple. Well, there was one owl who's on the back cover of the book. He's a spotted eagle owl that was really very lovely. And he kept flying over to me while we were photographing and sort of landing on my shoulder, which I felt pretty excited about because it's really thrilling to be around them. Like, I feel so lucky to be able to work with them. And since a very young age, I've really loved being around animals. So it's definitely something I feel pretty lucky to be able to do. I did have a black vulture use my head as a perch, which was thrilling and a little bit scary, if I'm being honest, at the same time. He sort of palmed my head with these very large talons, sort of reminiscent of those wire head scratchers. But definitely, even thinking about it, I get a little, you know, hair on edge moment. But it was really a very sweet vulture. I just was not quite expecting that to happen.
Well, you were still alive, so I guess the vulture wasn't that interesting.
Yeah, and this is a really darling vulture, and I think they are very intimidating to look at, but they're really pretty sweet. This one in particular was a very sweet creature, but they have it a little bit rough in the looks department, I would say, from an intimidation standpoint. but so important for the environment. So we appreciate them.
I think darling vulture, Claire Rosen, that's the first time I've ever heard that particular phrase.
Yeah, her name was Hoover.
Oh, Hoover.
Yeah.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Because right, then when there's stuff on the highway, they come and Hoover it off, right?
Yes, take care of it.
How many photographs are in your book?
There are 120 photographs. And I think maybe 55 species represented. I have to fact check myself on that one.
And so are there hundreds of photographs that you didn't use?
There are. There are. Yes, I worked with a creative consultant that I've been working with for a very long time. So she's really familiar with my background and my work to do the edit and the sequencing. And it was certainly no small task to cull down from the thousands of images to arrive at what would end up in the book and to sequence it in a way that felt dynamic and that you wouldn't get, you know, sort of bored or hung up. There's sort of a lyrical flow through it that I think she implemented pretty successfully. And it was really interesting for me just to go back to shoots that I had done 10 years earlier and re-look through the whole take to see what I had missed. So I had pulled out some images that I had passed over, you know, originally to bring that into the body of work. So, and I think also just whenever you work on a project for such a long period of time, you obviously like learn things and evolve the way that you're shooting. So it was interesting to see the way I changed what I picked or how I set up the shoots, you know, after doing it sort of so many times. But there is just sort of a magic that you can't really pinpoint for the ones that, you know, really speak to you and the ones that don't. Like all the things can be the same, the background, the lighting, the colors. And then there's these moments of real connection where you're like, oh, that's the one.
Yeah. Let's go a little deeper into that. What are you looking for when you're looking at a bird that you've taken a picture of? You want it to, the bird has to have some kind of sort of quality.
I mean, there's sort of the foundational aesthetic principles that I think run through a lot of classic artwork in terms of sort of color, harmony or contrast, and the negative space and the shapes that they make. But I do think that there's something sort of indescribable in the expression that, that pulls you in, that I think they can become sort of anthropomorphized as, and we kind of attribute human-like emotions or feelings to them. And I like those moments of connection where I'm hoping that it engenders a little bit more empathy and care for these creatures because you can relate to them in that sort of human level and not think of them as, oh, that's just, you know, a chicken.
It's never just a chicken. But Claire Rosen, your interest in Victorian times and the Victorian kind of look that you have to the birds, is that related to, like, I mean, right now things are strange in our country, our politics are stressful, but when I visit my horse or when I'm petting my cat, like, they just don't know anything about that. So when you take a bird and put it in this Victorian setting, are you referencing that kind of thing at all, or is that just me?
Well, so to give a little bit more context to the backstory, when I first released the project, it got some very nice attention, some lovely press. And in one of the online articles in the comment section, I was trolled by animal rights activists, which at the time was pretty brutal and sort of horrifying. They were really angry that I had used pet store birds. And I, you know, whatever research I thought I had done in picking a, you know, a respectable place, but they were just angry about the industry in general. And while it was really difficult to, at the time, it, you know, was pretty upsetting, but it led me down this wormhole of researching and understanding the plight that these creatures face. You know, people think they're going to be great, easy pets, but they're quite complicated emotionally. So if you don't provide the right environment for them, they really can go a bit mad. And as a result, many of them are surrendered to shelters. So it's a pretty big problem that these birds face, not sort of having the adequate care that they need in a domestic setting. And I guess it really made me realize, just sort of looking back, I really have always been drawn to animals, have always loved them, but sort of for my own enjoyment. I knew that I got a lot out of them, but I didn't really always think so much about like what was in their best interest. Like even having parakeets, you know, I thought I was providing for them, but still, I think knowing what I know now, working with so many birds, I don't know that I would put them in that environment again. And I think like I used to love going to the circus when I was little, and it was so thrilling to see the animals, but you know, being more aware, I now understand that that's not a great environment for them to be in. So I think specifically for the bird project, it just changed the whole context of the project for me. So I started to think of the wallpaper as these man-made interiors that we bring these creatures into for our own pleasure because we enjoy them. They look beautiful, but it's not really where they belong. And I started thinking about my work in a very different way, that the work could be decorative, but it could also have these sort of layers of conversation under them. And I could share some things about these birds, and that I could possibly donate some small amount of the profits to organizations working with these birds with the work, because it is appealing and beautiful and people would purchase it for their homes. So it could have these layers into it to have the sort of conversations around the things I was exploring and the things that I was interested in, and sort of operate on these two levels. So that sort of way of thinking about my artwork has really translated into all of the projects that I've done since then, including an animal feast project, yeah, and little animals at home. And so just really thinking about whimsical and engaging ways to engender more empathy and care for the natural world, I think is the sort of like underlying thread through all of the work, but using these, you know, charming childhood references and whimsy, nostalgia, a little bit of surrealism to, I don't know, I hope open people's minds to hearing the information in a way that feels like a little bit less aggressive and accusatory as I first came across it, which I felt like didn't really, well, I mean, I guess ironically it did inspire me to do things differently, but you know, I think there's a different way to have these very complicated conversations that aren't necessarily so black and white.
Did animal activists, I don't know what to call them, ever harass you before with your work? Because you've always had little animals doing silly things.
Well, when I first started, I wasn't working with animals so specifically. I had a sort of self-portrait series that was based in fairy tales, and then I sort of moved into kind of more commercial fashion work that kind of felt of the fairy tale world, and you start to see more and more animals with the models coming in, and and this sort of realization, like I really wanted to be around the animals. So the bird project was not something that I did that was commissioned. It was really just a project I did for me, and I didn't really even think that anybody would like it, but I got such a kick out of it. And it really started because I had been looking for a toucan for an assignment that I had. And so I went to visit this bird store and was just like enamored with all of the birds as I walked around, and being like, oh, I have to figure out some way that I can work with these, because they're so beautiful. So it like sort of started as this visual, aesthetic interest. And then, as I worked with them, just realizing, you know, the connection and how, I don't know how much I wanted to sort of share their personalities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was kind of a shock then that suddenly these people were,
I was not expecting that reaction. But now I do feel like people can get angry about many things.
Yeah. Just about anything. I think. Yeah.
But this was really this was in 2013. So. Mm,
right. So.
It was really a while ago. Oh, I feel so old now.
Well, it's really a beautiful book, and I want people to be able to find it. So how does one get a hold of Birds of a Feather?
The best way is to fly over to my website, and which is clararosen.com, and click on Books and Stationery, and it should pop up right there.
Beautiful. It is absolutely beautiful book. And you also sell individual prints of the birds?
Yes, I do sell prints of the birds and some stationery collections as well.
Well, it's all beautiful. And do you have any exhibitions coming up?
I am working on that right now. We had a little bit of a timeline in uncertainty with getting the book here. I published and printed in Italy, which was so fabulous. Oh. But the timeline for it arriving was very unclear, and this book was delayed several times. It took over 2 years just to work on the book. So I'm working now probably for next year's schedule of exhibitions.
Well, I hope that you'll come back and talk to us again and keep us informed on what you're up to.
I know. I wanted to tell you that I recently found a letter that you wrote me. You sent me a letter. You sent me the letter B.
Oh, actually, it's a good letter.
When I was a baby. You did say it was one of your favorites. I don't know if that's still the case.
Oh, yeah, I like B. Yeah, it's a good letter.
But you have great handwriting also. And this is like just a treasure that I found. I don't know if you remember writing this to me.
Well, it looks like I just wrote it the other day. I drew a little.
Well, it's got a poodle and a stegosaurus on it.
They're often seen together.
Yes, but this is the first time I've been able to read it, because when you sent it, I was not able to read. So it was kind of exciting.
Well, it's very nice that you still have it.
Yeah, on my birthday. So coming up.
Happy birthday.
Well, December, yeah, a few more weeks, but December 3rd, yeah. But you did welcome me to Earth, which was it's a good letter. So thank you for that.
My pleasure. All right. Well, we'll keep in touch then. Claire Rosen, you can find her at clarerosen.com and her beautiful new book, Birds of a Feather. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Joining me now is Lissa Warren. She is the founder and president of Lissa Warren PR, a company that specializes in book and author publicity. She's a professor at Emerson College in Boston. She's active on the Twitter at Lissa_Warren. I think I got that right. And she joins me here occasionally on From the Bookshelf. Lissa, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Gary.
What are you reading?
I am reading Austrian Again, and the subtitle is Reclaiming a Lost Legacy. The author is Anne Hand. One morning in the summer of 2020, Anne was casually reading The Guardian, as one does, when she saw a headline that would change her life. That headline was, Austria offers citizenship to the descendants of Jews who fled the Nazis. Now, in Austrian Again, which is a memoir, she chronicles the ensuing months and years during which she grappled with the decision to apply for Austrian citizenship. And it's something she had never really thought of doing prior to hearing that it was a possibility. It was something of which she wasn't even sure that her proudly Viennese but staunchly forward-looking grandfather would have approved of. And she navigated the country's rather bureaucratic reparation citizenship process with steely will and grace and calm. But this is not just the story of her legal pursuit to gain dual citizenship. While trying to unearth the information that would support her eligibility, Anne Hand waded through fragments of familial stories and dozens of ancestral documents, uncovering a gap that would make her family's hidden Holocaust history very clear. It was something her family had never talked about. Members of her family, some of them maybe even never knew about. But there was a box that a great aunt had willed to her that had been passed on, and she went through it and found out a lot of family secrets. The book shows what it means to be lost, you know, in time, for your family's heritage to be lost. But it also shows what it's like to gain new footing in today's world. Austrian, again, is really a profound reflection on memory and identity and a joyful tribute to the power of belonging, which is something we all very much need right now. And I can't help but look at this book through the lens of everything that is going on in the world today. It is a much needed reminder of our collective immigrant past.
Wow, that sounds like a fascinating book. And tell me more.
So good.
Tell me more about Anne Hand.
She was born in New York in 1985. She's pretty young. She currently divides her time between Massachusetts, where her parents still live, and Mexico City, where she does a lot of work. She has a bachelor's from McGill University and a master's of education, actually, from Harvard. And she has spent her career blending research and policy and practice to create social impact in the Americas and beyond. So she is somebody who has a real global view, looking in particular at global education, but how interesting that her own worldview expanded so much during this process.
Wow, is this her first book?
It is. It's her first, and boy, I hope she does more. I hope she's got more in her, because she's a wonderful writer, and just, you know, such a serious student of history, like not a history scholar, but boy, she dug deep. She did the necessary research to understand what was behind the stories that were behind all of these scraps, literally scraps, some of them that she found in this box of family memorabilia and mementos.
Well, it sounds really interesting. And the title again is?
Austrian Again, Reclaiming a Lost Legacy.
By Anne Hand. Oh, well, that sounds like a good one. Alyssa, thank you for bringing it to our attention. I'm going to put it on my list.
My pleasure.
Before we go, let's hear one more song from my guest, singer-songwriter Sam Milton, from his new album, Nausea. Here's Hum.
Someday you'll ask yourself if it's good as you'd expect, or if some night you called it, some night you called it for the best. Takes its rest. Someday the force to realize will usher that one dream to an end and pivot you there quiet and quickly to the stable job that just makes sense. It's rest. Every single thought grows cloudy with only anger, hate, and dread. Tire marks and exhaust fumes burning holes in your well-worn bed. soul for this final delusion that's breaking under your false head. Inadequacy takes no illusion, it's currency from your copied hand. But no love takes its rest.
That was Hum by Sam Milton. Check him out at Bandcamp or at sam-milton.com. That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, "Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf." And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.